During the past year, whilst traversing in the society of some scientific friends, that portion of Wisconsin territory, which is bounded by Illinois to the south and the beautiful Wisconsin River to the north, we frequently found our attention attracted by the singularly formed Indian mounds, of which the elevated prairies, as well as the rich valleys and the borders, had been lately circulating in the United States and contributed to lead our attention towards those singular memorials which daily presented themselves on the route through this interesting region. As relates to a great number of other positions, it was discovered that the configurations of the earthworks, or mounds as they are usually termed, which at first sight appeared decidedly to resemble the sites, or ground plan and foundation lines of former buildings, were really designed as rude representations and outlines of certain animals, and even of the human figure. Something like 80% of the Wisconsin Indian mounds visible to Richard C. Taylor back in 1838 are gone, but those that remain give us plenty of reason to be curious about who built the mounds, when and why. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
What do we know about the daily lives of Wisconsin's mound builders? Where did they come from? And as we delve more deeply into their history with increasingly sophisticated methods, what are we learning about them? Our guest is staff archaeologist at the State Historical Society, Amy Roseborough.
Well, welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a look at Wisconsin and go as far back as we need to go to find the first evidence of any people who were here.
We are lucky in Wisconsin. We have some of the oldest sites recorded in North America. We know that people were here almost as soon as the ice was gone, and possibly even before.
And how long ago is that?
14,000 years or more. Farmers working their land in Kenosha County stumbled upon the remains of mammoths. And once archaeologists returned to those sites and began excavating, they found not only the very well-preserved remains of some of the largest mammoths ever excavated in America, they found stone tools with them as well and marks left behind on the bones showing that they had been killed and butchered by people.
And so if we go back to, like, the first settlers in Wisconsin, what were some of the ideas that they had, such as what we've seen in Richard C. Taylor's concept of what these mounds were and who built them? What were their early impressions?
Their early impressions, I'm sad to say, were not kind towards the Native Americans that they lived and interacted with. They thought that the mounds were too complex and would have required too much effort. The people they saw were undergoing removal, had suffered from starvation and disease, and their cultures had been badly disrupted. They weren't aware that the United States had a very deep and long and rich history. And so they interpreted the mounds as the creations of, the lost tribes of Israel, the Romans, the Carthaginians, Atlantis. They weren't quite up to aliens yet in the 1830s, but if they had have been, I'm sure they would have invoked extraterrestrials as well.
And what's known about the earliest people, the ones that, you know, who used the tools?
The very earliest people that came in, we used to call them the Clovis people, after a very particular spear point, very finely crafted, associated with the Clovisites. However, we're coming to understand that there were people here prior to Clovis. We know very little about them, other than that they arrived far earlier than we thought. They probably came along the western coast of the United States and very slowly settled the remainder of the continent.
Any thought on why they came?
Well, the same reason anybody would move, looking for food, new land, and exploring new horizons.
What were the places they settled first in what is now Wisconsin?
So far as we know, there are so few sites of that age, the southern half of the state. The further north you would have traveled, the worse, of course, conditions would have gotten. By the period of the Clovis people, we do know that there were people living on the Door Peninsula around Sturgeon Bay, which would have been right at the base of the glaciers. I think a very nasty place to live, very windy and cold and wet. But they were there.
We use the term Native American to imply people who were here before the Europeans came over and pretended they owned the place. But in terms of that broad category of Native American, what sorts of groups, what sorts of names do we start hearing for the people who were here?
Well, we don't know what they called themselves. We're talking about an incredibly long time span. And I often ask people to think about the men and women who built Stonehenge. If you ask, were they British, were they Scottish, were they Dubliners, you can't answer those questions because those entities did not exist at the time that Stonehenge was built. So we come up with names for them like Paleo-Indian, Archaic, Woodland, or we describe them on the basis of a pottery type or a spear point type. Those are called archaeological cultures. We have no idea, really, if they had any relationship to actual cultures or not. We hope they did.
Looking at the spear points that we have from these earliest residents, what were they using them for? What were they killing with them?
Anything. If it moved and could be eaten, I'm sure it was shot at some point in Wisconsin.
What was around?
At the end of the Ice Age, mammoths, mastodons, caribou, muskox, camels, horses, even a species of beaver that stood 4 feet high. Imagine how the fur trade would have gone if that hadn't gone extinct.
A very big hat.
What were the spears made out of, and how sophisticated are they?
Extremely sophisticated. The Paleo-Indian people, as you might imagine, they're hunting very large game. They need a technology that's going to keep them from being stomped upon. The spear points themselves are very finely crafted with a channel or a flute that runs from the base towards the tip and makes them thinner so that they could be set into a socket very firmly. They would have been attached to a short piece of wood, bone, or ivory called a fort shaft, only a few inches long, and that in turn would have been set loosely into a socket in a larger wooden or caned spear. And the whole apparatus would have been thrown not by hand, but with a tool called an atlatl or a spear thrower.
And that, I've seen you use an atlatl in the field. And it seems to give you a lot more power than if you were just throwing by hand.
Yes, it adds an extra joint to your arm, in effect. And someone who's very skilled with an atlatl, and I am not, can throw one the length of a football field without much effort at all. At closer range, they strike with great force and can be thrown very accurately. And we have finds in the U.S. of many animals killed, obviously, with atlatls, including a find of a bison in Texas, an extinct form, much larger than the bison we have today. And the spear point had been embedded through the front of the skull.
Wow.
With great force. It would have killed the animal instantly. And I'd like to show images of that find to school children, because if you've ever seen the scene in Dances with Wolves where the main character is being charged by the bison and he shoots and it slides to a stop at his feet, it would have been like that, only with an atlatl.
And, the skull is, I guess, the hardest bone in the body, and to pierce that with a stone point would require a lot of force, and that atlatl provided it.
And while the hunter was no doubt panicking.
Do we see evidence then that the culture, the inhabitants of this country, sort of followed the glacier north, or is it not that simple? As the glaciers retreated, did they not tend to move farther north?
Well, obviously you couldn't settle on top of the glacier.
Right.
So they did have to follow them north to an extent. But there has always been controversy over whether or not some groups walked into the Americas through the glaciers, through a gap that opened up between the ice descending from the Rocky Mountains and the ice that extended westward from Hudson's Bay. And that theory has gone in and out of favor. I believe it's coming back into favor now, but only as an alternate route. I think it would have been a horrendous trip through mud and terrible, terrible conditions.
A lot of bad hunting in between there, I would think.
I wouldn't think there would be much hunting at all. I believe the most recent hypotheses have them subsisting on scraps of moss.
Well, we know that Wisconsin winters can be bitter. What kinds of adaptations do you start seeing to the cold winters?
Surprisingly few. We don't have any evidence for large houses, the kind of earth lodges you see out on the Great Plains. You don't see any signs of substantial structures being built really until only about 1,000 years ago. And other than the occasional rock shelter site where people were definitely taking refuge inside caves, most people seem to have just managed the winter inside small temporary wigwam-type structures, which always amazes me.
A lot of fur is involved, one would think.
I would suspect so.
What about the sort of, I guess, accumulation of learning? If you're in a place where you need to know what's poisonous and what's not and kind of pass down some of that information, is there any evidence that learning was passed on or that people were gradually getting the hang of it?
It had to have been. We do see increasing use of plants over time. The Paleo-Indians are often stereotyped as big game hunters. We do know that they began using plants the second they could. They were harvesting berries. They were checking to see what was edible and what wasn't. And, of course, that knowledge would have accumulated as the years passed. And I'm sure each generation told stories of, you know, when Uncle Mervin, you know, ate the blue mushroom and what happened to him. And eventually people would have learned not only what was edible and what was poisonous, but what plants were medicinal and where you could find them and at what times of the year. And people began to schedule their lives around the plants and around the seasons. And archaeologically, that ushers in a period we call the Archaic, the post-Ice Age, and when people really began to adapt to the local environment around them.
Do we see evidence, or I should say, what point do we see evidence of trade for any distance?
Around the same time. As people began to settle into specific territories that they called their own, that reduced the amount of travel, of course. You'd move over into the next river valley and somebody would already be living there. So people began to trade as a way to get around the restrictions on travel and as a way to form alliances as well. And we see the beginnings not only of long-distance trade with stone and shell and metal moving over most of the Mississippi Valley, we see the beginnings of art at that point.
What kinds of art?
Oh, fantastic things. The atlatls I mentioned, many of them would have had stone weights on them called banner stones. And they were made from a polished stone, sometimes agates, chalcedonies, quartz, usually very brightly colored, something that would take a very high shine. And they would be made in the forms of butterflies and crescents. And working stone with stone is not easy. And they were choosing some of the hardest stones to make banner stones out of. An incredible amount of effort would have gone into that.
What about evidence of war, evidence of conflict?
Unfortunately, you see that as well. For the most part, at least in Wisconsin, it's small scale. A fight here or there, the occasional raid. There's nothing like all out, let's kill the other group and as many people as we can. You don't see that kind of warfare here. You do in other areas of the continent, especially if there are indications of starvation, of shortages, of invasion. But we seem to have escaped most of that.
And what were the staples in terms of the diet? What were most people eating in this, let's say, at the beginning of this archaic period?
As befits Wisconsin, deer. The deer hunt is important now, and it was important then. They also seem to have gotten quite a lot of meat from bear, from elk. In northern Wisconsin especially, we find a lot of fish remains. Sturgeon, a very large fish, provided a good amount of the diet. And with regard to plants, nuts, hickories, walnuts, some wild rice, not so much in the Archaic, but later on, certainly, berries, sumac.
Do we see material evidence of religion at this point?
Yes. We have cemeteries that date back to the Archaic period that have the bodies of people laid out with all the tools they would need for the afterlife, with ornaments covered with pigments and powders that are brightly colored. Red ochre in particular, it's an extremely bright red pigment. And that reflects some belief in an afterlife where tools will be needed, where finery would be needed. And the red color from the ochre has been interpreted as the blood of rebirth.
Or just to create a more lifelike cast, perhaps?
It's extremely bright red. I don't know how lifelike.
A little too bright for the yes. lifelike look.
Any assumptions that you can reach about the roles of males and females at this time?
Actually, yes. The cemeteries I was just speaking of, the early archaic cemeteries, it's interesting that most of the finery goes with women and not so much with men, which is a reversal of many parts of the world. So we believe that women may have actually been of higher status in some parts of Wisconsin than in other areas of the U.S. and other areas of the globe.
As in a matrilineal society, or just that they
can't be proven, but it is suggestive.
And what about the health, the medicine, the lifespan of some of the people?
The usual ailments, the occasional broken leg, depressed skull fracture. The teeth would get worn very quickly. The archaic people ground their plants, their nuts, with stone tools, and that would leave grit in the diet. And so by the time you were 30 or 40 or 50, your teeth were getting pretty worn flat.
But cavity-free.
But for the most part, cavity-free. It isn't until corn is introduced to Wisconsin.
With all the sugar in it.
Oh, absolutely. And then the teeth. Oh, you can tell. Archaeologists will often look at the teeth of a burial to determine whether it's pre-corn or post-corn, and it's a great sign.
And I suppose you see the stature increasing? I mean, people becoming taller or?
It fluctuates. There were some environmental variations in Wisconsin's history, times when it was much warmer than today, times when it was much cooler than today. And the health of people seems to have been affected by that in part, but also just the circumstances of their own lives. Signs of ill health really increase when Europeans arrive. And Europeans brought with them a whole host of diseases that the Native Americans had no immunity to at all. And at the same time, populations began to move. There were invasions. New technologies were replacing old technologies. Everything was in incredible turmoil. And we see people who suffer terrible diseases, injuries, warfare picks up. Even dental health goes right down to the dumper.
Well, communicable diseases wouldn't be that, I presume, that big an issue for pre-Columbian Indians just because they were so spread out. There wouldn't be as much likelihood that you would get something from somebody else.
So spread out, yes. And also the vectors of disease weren't here. Europeans lived, for the most part, with their farm animals, as did most Asians. If you look at a medieval European house, the cattle are indoors with you. You're sleeping in one half of the house. The cattle are doing their business in the other
immunity.
Half of the house. Diseases were passed back and forth between animals and people regularly. The Native Americans did not have herd animals, nothing that they could domesticate and keep. We have some indications that some groups in the Southwest were breeding ducks and turkeys, and some of the Central American groups were breeding parrots for their plumage, but they weren't herding deer or buffalo. So they just did not have the disease here to transmit to one another.
We're going to look more at the early people of Wisconsin when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Amy Roseborough, who is telling us about the earliest settlers of Wisconsin, by which we mean the very first people to get here. And we've talked about hunting and gathering and some pretty lean conditions, but you also mentioned corn as a way of indicating that these people had settled down and were actually settling into an agricultural lifestyle. And when does that happen?
Actually, well before corn.
Does it?
People associate Native American agriculture with corn. It's become the symbol of the Indian agricultural lifestyle, and it is extremely important and one of the finest things ever bestowed upon humanity, as far as I'm concerned. But the first agriculture in Wisconsin involved a suite of crops that we call the Eastern Agricultural Complex. You will be aware of sunflowers, squash, so pumpkins. But the complex also involved plants that you are probably pulling out of your garden and throwing away now, believing that they're weeds. Lamb's quarters. It's a close relative of quinoa, which is still grown in some circles. Marsh elder, little barley.
Queen Anne's lace, or is that a latter-day
phenomenon? Latter-day. They're plants that produce very small seeds that are high in oils and fats. And while the modern diet is very fat conscious and that we need to get rid of the fat, as you noted, Wisconsin gets very cold. And if you're going to survive a winter, fat is your friend.
Sure. Okay, so we have
kind
an excuse.
Of, yes.
Yeah. Bulk up.
So sort of an anti-starvation diet.
Absolutely.
And so you're saying that these became crops in a sense, or they became harvested or grown more than just for individual use?
Yeah. We see in the archaeological record, if you compare the seeds of the domesticated versions to wild goosefoot seed, for example, you see that the seeds themselves are larger, the seed coat is thinner. They show every sign of being domesticated and bred for larger seed size and for more nutrition. So the people were changing the plants around them. At the same time, they were manipulating the landscape by firing the prairies, by setting fires on purpose to keep the trees that would normally cover Wisconsin from growing. That kept the prairies healthy. It provided great habitat for deer, and they would also carry the seeds of cherry trees, berry bushes, wild grapes from place to place and scatter them as they went. Not a agriculture as we would interpret it, but it's certainly a manipulation of the landscape in order to, well, I call it the, you know, the 100-mile Walmart.
Yeah, it does require a little bit of a commute, but sure, a burned-off landscape is great situation for, say, growing blueberries.
Yeah.
One thing we think about with early Native American settlements would be pots. You know, how far back do we go in Wisconsin before we start seeing pots?
Around the same time that agriculture comes in. Once you have a bunch of tiny little oily seeds, you have to have some way to cook them. And if you're going to make soup or stew without pottery, it's doable but tedious. You have to find a basket or a leather bag, soak it in water, fill it with water, put a very hot rock in the water, and hope that you can get the water to boil and the food to cook before the rock burns through the bottom of the basket or the bag. So the first person to notice that clay got really hard in a fire and think, hey, I could make a container out of that, I'm sure they were, you know, hailed as a genius and wanted for nothing for the rest of their lives.
Now, why do we start using this term woodland Indians for Wisconsin inhabitants?
Well, again, we don't know what they call themselves. We have to classify everyone in some way. The woodland hallmarks, agriculture, pottery, and burial mounds are extremely prevalent in the eastern half of the U.S. where, after contact, the forests grew. So they were called the woodland Indians. Now we know that that is just a stage of technology that was shared by innumerable cultures, villages, and peoples over a huge area of the continent.
And if you found, let's say, a new site that had some evidence of these woodland Indians, what sort of characteristics would you observe in the pots that would tell you, before even carbon dating or anything else scientific, what would be the sort of the hallmarks?
The decoration of the pottery. Mm-hmm. Just like cars change over time, like clothing changes over time, the way that the pottery was decorated changed as well. So we divide the woodland period up into blocks based on pottery decoration. Again, we have no idea if these are different groups of people, if it are just changes in technology or fashion, but it's handy for us at least. So we have early woodland pots that are decorated with scratched lines and the impressions of people's fingernails. That moves to the middle woodland when people were decorating pots with pieces of shell that had been notched into a tooth-like form. We call them dentate stamps. And people would push those into the pots. When the late woodland arrives, people switch to impressing woven cordage and fabric into the pottery. And that's one of my favorite pottery types in Wisconsin. They can be extremely beautiful. And the weaving that they preserve pressed into their surfaces is just elaborate and gorgeous.
Do we start seeing evidence, again, of, in this time I'll say, religious structures that would have no other apparent use?
Yes and no. The mounds themselves appear at this point, the first burial mounds. They have a use, obviously, which is to bury people. But you also see at the beginning of the woodland period and just a little earlier, things that we call ceremonial caches. And these are deposits of extremely finely chipped stone traded from a long distance. The preferred type is a type of Indiana hornstone that is a gorgeous slate blue. And they would chip these into very long, almost sword-like forms, bury them standing on end, bury them in spiral patterns, circular patterns, douse them in the red pigment, and then cover them up and walk away. Now, they weren't buried with anybody. They were just buried. So they must be offerings of some sort. It's extremely expensive material being put in the ground.
I've heard about the Hopewell cult. How does that fit into the story here?
The Hopewell were thought to be a people that originated in Ohio and spread out. We now understand the Hopewell is more of a religion, an idea that spread across most of eastern North America from Florida up to Maine, from the East Coast, out past the Mississippi River. And in Wisconsin, the locals appear to have looked at the cult and gone, yeah, that's for us. And you find at sites of that age the normal everyday pottery and the extra special religious Hopewell pottery, which is made to mimic the Hopewell style. When people died, they were buried in Hopewell burial mounds, which involved log tombs in which families were placed and objects traded over enormous distances. In the western part of the state near Tremplo, excavations into the Hopewell mounds found obsidian from Yellowstone National Park, marine shells from the Gulf Coast, copper plates made out of Lake Superior copper, mica from the Appalachians, musical instruments, jewelry, knives, you name it, they went in.
Now, you mentioned that these tombs enclosed families?
So far as we know.
So
they were log-lined structures, large enough to hold, in some cases, 50 or more people. And we believe, based on excavations at mound sites in Ohio and Illinois, that the tombs were covered with bark or with hide or with wood until they were full.
Okay, so they're like mausoleums.
Essentially. And when another death would occur, they would remove the lid, put the new body in. Some cases, we note that there wasn't quite enough room for the new body, but they weren't quite ready to build a mound yet, so they would push everyone else out of the way.
Well, they still do that in New Orleans, I think.
But these would be just sort of mounds or tombs underground that you can see a swelling observable from the top, or...
If the mound was never built, you can't see a thing. And we have had instances in Monona, just south of Madison, where a road grader working near a large Hopewell mound hit a non-mounded tomb, much to everyone's surprise and shock. And that required a rather hurried excavation to remove the bodies out of the path of the road. Similar unmarked tombs have been found in the Mississippi near Prairie du Chien. Why people decided not to go ahead and build a mound, we don't know. Perhaps something happened to that family. Perhaps they had to move on.
Well, not everybody got a pyramid in Egypt.
Yes, that's true.
It's a matter of time and expense.
And when do we first start seeing effigy mounds?
Effigies were invented around 700 AD. And again, it's going to be one of those cases where the person who thought of it got all kinds of attention because it was a great idea. Instead of making a normal dome-shaped mound of earth over a burial, why not say something about the person buried there by making the mound in the shape of an animal that represented that person, their family, a society they belonged to, a religious organization? We don't know for sure what the mound specifically represent. But if you go to Forest Hill Cemetery in Madison, you can find the tombstone of Charles E. Brown, and it simply says archaeologist. As we think that the effigies were something like that, that if you saw a bear-shaped effigy mound, then that person must have been Bear Clan or must have been a member of the Bear Society.
And there are actually mounds in that cemetery that you mentioned.
Yes,
it's
there
a
are.
A fascinating place because the graves, the latter-day graves, are actually placed around the mounds.
And that's not uncommon at all either. Once a place is consecrated, whether the burials first took place in the Archaic period or later on during the Woodland period, people would return to it and add more. So we have sites where we have archaic cemeteries with mounds on top of them, European stones on top of that, and churches nearby.
So a lot covered. And are there particular animals that get chosen more often than others for the effigies?
Yes. Bears are common. Very long-tailed creatures that are termed panthers, though they are probably water spirits, based on current Native American art and imagery. Birds of various types.
Eagles, I guess, are popular.
Eagles, we think. It's hard to tell in effigy form species, but we believe eagles, probably some spirit animals like thunderbirds. Some of the bird mounds have forked tails, which would identify them either as swallows or a bird you don't see around here much anymore called a swallow-tailed kite. It would be a raptorial bird with a very long forked tail.
Now, as we look at these mounds today, and you can see, well, many of them, of course, between Madison and Lake Mills and this part of Wisconsin, as we look at them today, we're likely to see something that's not more than a couple of feet high and blends in pretty well with the surroundings. But what would they have looked like 1,000, 1,200 years ago?
I wish I could answer that. I'd go back in time and see them. The mounds that we see now are, of course, a little worn down. But we don't believe they were much higher than we see today. Some of the best preserved ones are around 3 to 4 feet high. And so that was probably closer to their height. They were never as large as the earlier dome-shaped mounds. The Hopewell mounds were made to cover tombs, entire families. So they were extremely large and could be, anywhere 10, 20 feet high. The effigies are usually built to mark the graves of one person, maybe two people. So they don't have to be quite as high. Now, they can be quite long. The largest surviving mound we have in Wisconsin is just north of Madison, and it is over 600 feet.
That's that bird, thunderbird or eagle or whatever it is.
Very, very large bird mound.
It now has a couple of what, power lines running through one wing?
Sidewalks. Yeah. Sidewalks.
These effigy mounds, were they all burial mounds so far as we know?
So far as we know, yes. Based on excavations into the mounds conducted, I should add, well before 1986, when all burial mounds became protected by state law. Most of the mound excavations took place in the 1930s or prior. And if you look at the excavation reports, well over 90%, we believe, had burials in them. And I suspect that all of them did.
And were they mostly for important people, sort of leaders, or do you find effigy mounds for everyday folks, children, and so on?
Can you tell?
You find children in the mounds, women, men. They aren't accompanied by wonderful grave goods like you see in the Hopewell period. There's no obsidian. At most, you might find one or two arrow points, a knife, maybe a cooking pot, if you're really lucky. But the mounds themselves seem to be saying something. If your group is going to the effort of building a 600-foot-long, several-foot-tall sculpture over you, you have to be important in some way. And we know that not everybody during that period got mound burial. There are graves from that period with no mounds on them at all, some in rock shelters, some next to mounds, some far away from mounds. And even if you were buried underneath a mound, it wasn't a given that you got an effigy. There are round mounds, like you see in the Hopewell period, though much smaller, and long mounds that we call linears. They look like embankments. So were the effigy people the richest people? I suspect that they probably were. They're just not being buried with the goodies.
Where would you most likely find a mound? Do they tend to favor hills? Do they tend to favor areas along water? Or what would be the choice real estate for a mound?
It depends on where you are in the state. Just like today, you know, people lived in various communities. There was a community of effigy builders at Madison, another in Milwaukee, another in Beloit, around the Dells, Prairie du Chien. Wherever you see a large settlement today, for the most part, there were mounds. And in each area, in each community, they had their own ideas about where the mound should be built. So if you go to the Horicon Marsh, they're almost always on the tops of the hills. If you go out towards the Mississippi River, in some areas they are always right on the riverbank. In some places they are on the toe slope of the bluff. Then you move up to the next community and everything's on the top of the bluff. And again, preference. Whoever was directing the ritual had their own ideas about where the mound should go.
How much of it had to do with getting there first, though? I mean, if we go to a place like, you know, the Pheasant Branch Conservancy, which has this great, I guess it's a glacial drumlin that overlooks everything, this great hill, and has mounds on it, where would you find the first ones, and then where would you start finding the later ones?
If people were returning to a site that had already been used for burial and there were already mounds there, chances are the first mounds are in the most prominent part of the landform, the highest part, the part closest to the water. And there is almost always water someplace. Either you can see it from the top of the hill where you're standing or it is right at your feet. If the effigy builders came to a site, wanted to build a mound there and found out that it was already covered with mounds, they would find a way. There are sites where the effigies are wedged right in there just as tightly as they can go.
Do we know who built them? In other words, was it a kind of an artisan trade, or was it something that certain people learned how to do?
I suspect it was a trade, that certain families were in charge of designing the mounds. If you look at the styles of the effigies, in Madison, for example, we have mounds in the form of geese. They have very long necks, rounded heads, and then beautifully crafted folded or zigzag wings. So they represent geese in flight. If you go to the Horicon Marsh, which is the next community of effigy builders to the northeast of Madison, there are also goose mounds, but the wings aren't zigzagged. They're straighter, they're curved. So whoever was in charge of building goose mounds in each area, they had their own style, their own particular way of doing things, specific to their community.
Do we see any evidence that any of these mounds or groups of mounds have any kind of orientation to sun, moon rise, seasonal phenomena of a celestial nature?
You can't ever rule it out. At any particular site, you can say maybe. If you look at effigy mounds as a whole, the longest mounds are oriented slightly more towards the cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west, than you would expect by chance. But as a whole, there are no widespread orientations towards the solstices, towards the equinox, towards moonrise, moonset, or any other celestial feature we can identify.
Do you think there might be some effigy mounds that haven't been discovered in the state yet?
Sure. They pop up sporadically to this day. We'll get notifications in a couple of instances from state parks where people really should have known better. But in the very rugged parts of the southwestern corner of the state, in the bluffs, hiding in the woods, at the bases of the bluffs, they're still there.
We'll see if we can find out what happened to the mound builders, why the trend died out after several hundred years, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Amy Roseborough from the State Historical Society, and we are talking about the early people of Wisconsin. So these mound builders that created the beautiful effigies that we can find, what happened to them?
They stuck around. They didn't go anywhere. For a long time, archaeologists had this idea that there had been an invasion from the south and that the effigy builders had been driven out of the state. And the archaeology now was pointing us in a completely different direction, that rather than an invasion, a new religion and a new way of life was introduced. The people living here thought, okay, this works, and began adopting facets of a culture we called Mississippian, introduced by people who lived in a site called Cahokia near modern-day St. Louis. And the descendants of the effigy builders became Mississippians themselves. Mississippians became today's Native nations. So the Ho-Chunk will readily tell you that they are descended from the effigy builders.
Cahokia was at sort of the high point. It's such a large complex.
It is an incredible place. Another site that has been terribly undervalued and overlooked. If you happen to travel to St. Louis or near St. Louis, check it out. It is the closest thing to a city, a Native American city in the eastern U.S. It was a monstrous place, centering upon an area we call downtown Cahokia. And at the heart of downtown Cahokia is a mound we call Monk's Mound. It's 100 feet high, has a base of 15 acres, and would have been topped at its peak with a building that itself stood 50 feet or more high. And the family that lived on top of Monk's Mound was very important.
And what time period are we talking about?
Around 1050 AD. That's what we call the Big Bang, when Cahokia suddenly took off from being a fairly small settlement to ballooning to as many as 40,000 people in greater Cahokia alone. That's not counting the suburbs of Cahokia, the farmsteads that surrounded Cahokia. It was an incredible place. More mounds than you can imagine. It would have looked very much like a modern city, only instead of skyscrapers, you would have seen buildings on top of earthen structures and then smaller houses in between them.
So did mound building gradually die out, or do we see an abrupt change?
Fairly abrupt. Once the Mississippians arrived, Cahokians sent emissaries, traders, and even some colonists to Wisconsin. Aztalan State Park is their most famous settlement, a place where late woodland effigy mound building peoples had been living. The Cahokians showed up, settled with them, and then decided that they would turn Aztalan into a tiny little version of Cahokia. They built a wall around it. They began erecting earthen platforms for their important buildings, a temple, what we call a charnel house, where the bodies of the elite dead were laid out prior to their burial, and probably the chief's residence as well. And at the same time Aztalan was being constructed, a small colony seems to have moved up from Cahokia to the area of Tremplo, where they built a second platform mound complex on some bluffs and then established a settlement down below closer to the river. And those areas may well have acted like magnets. If you are an effigy builder and you're fishing on the banks of the Rock River, and then you see coming towards you a 20-foot-long painted dugout canoe filled with people waving war clubs, covered in feathers, shell beads, and tattoos, it's going to make an impression on you.
And so what kind of burial practices did they have then in Cahokia?
Cemetery.
But nothing that would have had the effigies or the same kind of decorative
approach. No, the effigy people would have been just as foreign to the Cahokians as the Cahokians were to the effigy builders. If you were an extremely rich Cahokian, the kind of person who lived on the top of Monk's Mound, you were buried in a mound of your own accompanied by sacrifices. In the case of at least one paramount chief at Cahokia, many, many young women between the ages of 18 and 40 went with you to the afterlife, not voluntarily, I should imagine. Once the Cahokians settled in Wisconsin and began intermarrying with Late Woodland peoples, we believe they introduced a ceremony called green corn. The Cahokians were corn farmers. Now, the effigy builders knew about corn. They grew a little of it. But it wasn't until the Cahokians arrived that people began to really plant corn and rely on it to keep themselves alive. And the green corn ceremony, we think, took over for effigy building. It's a way that people can commingle with one another, have a good time. There are feasts, dances. It's the time of year when people would get divorced, get married, name their children.
I didn't know they got divorced.
Oh, absolutely.
How do we know that?
People are people.
But is there evidence that you can point to?
Post-contact. The green corn ceremony was extremely widespread at contact. It had covered most of the eastern U.S. Everywhere that Mississippian groups had settled, you find green corn. And wherever green corn is practiced, it's practiced in very nearly the same way. It's seen almost as a New Year type of ceremony when old fires would be put out, new fires would be kindled, there would be beginnings and ends for the community as a whole during the green corn.
And if there's intermarriage, then do you have a new people, a new culture that's coming up out of it?
Yes. And we can see that happening at a couple of sites in Wisconsin, a place called Diamond Bluff, where Cahokians were visiting. They were trading with the people at Diamond Bluff. There were people arriving at Diamond Bluff from other parts of Wisconsin. Effigy builders were moving there. People from the northern half of the state were moving there. People from the Great Plains were coming eastward to the vicinity of Diamond Bluff, trading with one another, sitting down and intermarrying. The pottery, if you look at the pottery from Diamond Bluff, it almost looks like all the women who'd made pottery sat down and said, okay, here are all the different ways we decorate pottery, make pottery, add temper to our clay, take them apart, put all those ideas in a giant bag, and then every time someone made a new pot, they would reach into the bag and pull out random ideas. So my next pot is going to be shell-tempered with loop handles, have a smooth surface, an incised body, and cord-decorated rims. It's this wild mixture of ideas and styles that formerly very separate people had used up until that point. We see this great coming together at Diamond Bluff, and then something entirely new pops out the other side.
And how long did that last? Does that last until first contact with Europeans?
It lasted until about 1200 AD. So in the span of a couple of centuries, effigy mound building went away. Mississippians transformed the local population into a group that we call the Oneota. And there were Oneota living at La Crosse, at Diamond Bluff, Lake Koshkonong, Lake Winnebago, the Dora Peninsula. And it is those groups, we believe, that are the ancestors of today's Ho-Chunk, the Menominee, the Iowa, the Missouri, the Oto, and perhaps even the Dakota.
And what kind of structures did they have?
Long houses. So extremely long, as you might imagine, houses that would have held extended families. Some sites have smaller rectangular cabins that would have held perhaps a nuclear family or two. It depends really, again, on where you are in the state. The longhouse form seems to have been the most popular.
And what kind of evidence do you find of the impact of the Europeans in terms of disease or warfare or other things that sort of show the gradual decimation of some of the people?
We see a gap. If you look at the sites and attach dates to them, once you hit about 1500 AD, around the time that the epidemics begin in Mexico. Suddenly, there are no radiocarbon dates in Wisconsin anymore. We believe that the population crashed. And estimates for mortality from the first few pandemics reached the order of 85 to 90%. So you can imagine, you know, 9 out of every 10 people dropping dead in the space of a couple of decades. It's going to cause incredible harm to the survivors. Once the population rebounded, adapted to the new situation to the point that we again begin to see archaeological sites, well, by that time European trade goods have arrived. So the traditional things that we would use to identify the Oneota groups, the pottery, is barely being produced.
If you have an iron pot, it's kind of hard to tell
exactly
where it came from and where it went.
A trade kettle is a trade kettle is a trade kettle.
Those things were embraced, though, I gather, for the most part by the Native Americans when they saw some of these technological improvements, whether it was a firearm or a pot, they gravitated toward them.
Oh, absolutely. The first pots that made their way westward were probably in pretty bad shape. We do know that there was a prolonged period of a century or so where the trade in European items was being directed and controlled entirely by Native groups. The Odawa, for example, in the eastern Great Lakes were making trips into Wisconsin as early as the 1500s. So just as the population was beginning to rebound, they were here with kettle brass. And that brass, the scraps of kettles, were being made into beads, into ornaments, and into other tools. Once more intact material began to make its way westward, you can imagine, if you're given a choice between putting a fairly fragile, heavy clay pot in a canoe and chucking in a nearly indestructible kettle, it's not hard to decide.
Right. You mentioned that there might still be some mounds and some sites that haven't been discovered yet. What are the rules right now governing finds? Let's say someone in their backyard discovers something underground that looks to be from a long time ago and from one of these early peoples.
It depends on what it is. If someone finds a spear point, good for them. And if they would like the Historical Society to identify it for them, we are more than happy. If they find a skull, on the other hand, then under state law, they're required to do first two things. First of all, they need to call the police. There's no guarantee that it's old. There are lots of missing people, unfortunately, in Wisconsin, and you never know when they're going to turn up. Second of all, they need to contact us. The Historical Society helps administer Wisconsin's burial sites law, which protects all burial places, regardless of age, from disturbance. So if someone comes up with a grave, let's say there had been a cemetery, the records say the cemetery had been moved, which almost always means it hasn't been, and someone putting in a swimming pool, and this did just happen in New Orleans, suddenly finds coffins, it doesn't mean that they don't get their swimming pool. It just means that archaeologists have to come out and help move the bodies someplace safer.
And is there ownership among the current Native American groups in Wisconsin of some of these earlier sites and the information from them?
Yes. The Ho-Chunk say that they know quite a lot about the effigy builders, and it's information that they're not entirely willing to share. It's personal, it's traditional knowledge, and if they wish to share it in the future, they can. Until then, we're not going to press them on the issue. With regard to the burials, whenever human remains are found, if they're Native American, they are offered to the tribes, and those tribes that feel it's their responsibility will step forward and take possession of the remains and give them proper burial in the location of their choosing.
Our guest this hour has been Amy Roseborough, who has filled us in quite a bit on not just some of the older ideas about the earliest inhabitants of Wisconsin, but also some of the latest discoveries. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.